Good morning. Go ahead and open up in your Bibles to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. We're going to begin our study there in just a moment. It was a really nasty day yesterday with the clouds and the rain and the storms that came in. What a beautiful day the Lord has given us to come together and worship. Thank you. This passage is kind of a reflection of life. You know, we have days that are dark and cloudy and stormy. But there's always tomorrow. The sun's always waiting behind those clouds. And it's, as Jeremiah said, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies are new every morning. And waking up and seeing the sun and seeing the blue sky and seeing all of the green and the life that surrounds us is a reminder of that. Let's begin by reading Romans chapter 8, verses 28 and 29. What I want to talk about this morning is the chisel of God. Paul writes in Romans chapter 8, verse 28, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers." What's the purpose of our existence? What's God's plan and purpose and intention for us? I think you could probably answer that in many ways and be right. But what is most significant, and perhaps one of those we think the least about, or talk the least about, is stated for us here in Romans chapter 8, verse 29. And it really comes on the heels and perhaps falls beneath the shadows of this great passage in verse 28, where we have this comforting promise for God that for those who love him, and for those who are called according to his purpose, God's going to work all things together for their good. But then he goes on in verse 29 to say that those whom he foreknew, he's predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. And so God's plan is for his people is to take and to conform them, to shape them into the image of Jesus. You can go way back to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 32, and you find out that God says, "Let us make man according to our image." We are, you go very back at the very beginning and find out that we are the image bearers of God. But then sin came along and messed that up, didn't it? It broke us, it corrupted us, it changed us, so that in the way that God intended, we don't bear the image of God anymore. We still have a semblance in which we bear God's image, in that God has given us free will, he's given us emotions, he's given us volition and a mind to think as he does. And so in that way, we bear God's image. But there was a shift at that point in time after Adam and Eve sinned, and that came into the world, that man hasn't worn God's image in the same way ever since. And so God sets out on this great mission, this great purpose, by which he is going to bring man back to himself. And in doing that, he's going to again bring us to the place where we once were, the place that sin left us behind. That is, to again be image bearers, his image bearers in the fullest sense of the word. And so when you become a Christian, that's what God begins to do. In fact, the language here is so strong is God has predestined you, and I don't think that means like he's writing the script in such a way that you can't resist, but those whom are going to be saved, God has said, "I have predestined those who will be saved are going to be conformed to the image of Jesus." Not perfectly, no, not in this life. But God begins to work in our life in such a way so that we begin to bear Jesus' image. Now, who here would say, I want some of that in my life? I don't know about you. Things are kind of busy and difficult around our house right now, and I could really use that in my life. I need God to work on me. I need God to get, here I am, this block of clay, and you know what an artist will do. They'll take a chisel and a hammer, and they'll shape that so that block of clay comes out bearing some, you know, wonderful, magnificent feature. It's a masterpiece. It's a work of art after they're done with it. But it's only done through the breaking of the hammer and the chisel upon the stone or the marble or whatever it may be. And so how many of us are thinking, I want that in my life? Well, if you're a Christian, you better. Because God has called you to this. God has called us to be conformed to the image of our Son, his Son. The question, though, becomes, and what we want to talk about, is what is the chisel that God uses? And this is one of those be careful what you ask for kind of questions. Yes, we want to be conformed to the image of Jesus. Yes, we want to look more like him in the way that we think and act and speak and our attitudes and our dealings with others and our relationship with God. We want to be more like Jesus.
But how does God bring that about? What's the utensils, what's the tools that he uses to conform us to the image of his son? Well, if you back up to verse 28 and you think about that, God uses all things to work together for our good. That's a passage we oftentimes use to help us deal with difficult times, hardships. And as you go on into verse 29, and as you think about, well, what is it that God uses to conform us to the image of Jesus and to make us look more like him? It's not going to be the beautiful, sunshiny, enjoyable days where everything is just smooth sailing in our life. Rather, it's going to be the challenging days. It's going to be the difficulties. It's going to be the trials and the hardships. That's where character is formed. That's where we're made to look more like Jesus. Trials are the chisel of God. And no, they're not any fun. But what happens is we come out looking more like Jesus. In fact, back up just a little bit to Romans chapter 5 and look at what Paul says there in the first few verses as he kind of speaks to this refining process that God conforms us to the image of Jesus. He says in Romans 5 verse 1, therefore, since we've been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through him we've also obtained access by faith into this grace in which we stand. We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. More than that, and here it comes, we rejoice in our sufferings. James has a similar sentiment where he says, brethren, when you fall into various trials, why? Knowing that suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope. It's part of the refining process. It's part of the way that God transforms us so that we look more like Jesus. But it takes suffering. It takes trials. It takes hardship. Life is filled with it, right? And I'm sure some of you are going through those right now. Trials can come in the form of health problems, of financial difficulties, of losing loved ones, moving away from loved ones, numerous ways, church problems, marriage problems. Our life is filled with trials, but that's what shapes us, that's what refines us, that's what produces hope and character within us so that we come out conformed more so to the image of Jesus. And so I want to show just four ways this morning in which trials shape us and make us more, look more like Christ. Go with me, if you will, to Genesis chapter 22. As we think about this idea that trials test the strength of our faith. Trials test the strength of our faith. Hard times show what your faith is made of. Hard times show how closely you're walking with the Lord. Listen, anybody can do what God calls them to do. Anybody can walk the narrow way when life is good, when things are easy, when it's all sunshine and rainbows and blue skies. Most people, I should say, not anyone. Most people can serve the Lord. And you know what it's like when things are smooth sailing in your life and the tempter just really doesn't seem to be knocking at your door. It's easy to walk with the Lord. But days like that aren't really show the metal of what lurks deep within our soul. Rather, it's when our faith is tried. It's when our faith is tested. It's when, like, the gold is put into the flame and it faces the heat that it reveals the purity of the gold, whether it's mostly dross or whether there's something pure and valuable and precious there. So it is with trials. They reveal the strength of our faith. And we see a man who faced trials, perhaps here, speaking from the perspective of a father, like no one else in Scripture that I can imagine. Genesis chapter 22, the first couple of verses. After these things, God tested Abraham. I said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Talk about a monumental test. Talk about showing Abraham, and that's what God's intended to do. Talk about showing Abraham the strength of his faith. Now, we know how the story is going to go. And so we know when we get to the New Testament why Paul calls Abraham the father of the faithful. Because Abraham's going to pass this test with flying colors. But you just get the sense, and one can only imagine what this must have been like for him. When God comes to him and God's made this spectacular promise to him to give him a son, and he gave him a son at 99 years old, and his wife of 90, miraculously empowering them to conceive and bring forth the child from themselves, and then saying he's going to be the seed from which this great nation is going to grow, and from which the entire world is going to be blessed. These marvelous promises have been given to Abraham by God, and then God comes to him when Isaac's probably, 16, 17, 18 years old. Says, I want you to take that son that I've given you. And you notice how God's just pressing down on Abraham's faith. He doesn't just say, take your son and go do this. Take your son, your only son. And so that's a reference to the promise, because it wasn't his only son. Ishmael was also his son. But your only son, as it pertains to the promise, not just your only son, but your only son whom you love. It's like he's pressing down, trying to make this as hard on Abraham as he can. Take him up to the mountain, I'm going to show you, and offer him there as a burnt offering to the Lord. Abraham might have rejected that. He might have said, hey, look, God, let's at least talk about this. He wasn't afraid to have that conversation with God. Think back to what God, when he came and told him, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. He's not afraid to negotiate with God. And so he might have said, I've got some concerns. I've got some questions. This seems very inconsistent with who you are and your holy character and what you've said. And now you're asking me to take my son and go up on a mountain and offer him up and take his life? He might have objected to what God said. He might have wanted to talk about it. Verse 3, so Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He doesn't linger. He doesn't drag his feet. He gets up early the next morning, gets Isaac, gets a donkey, gets a couple servants, and away they go to do what God has called him to do. God gives him 3 days. It's a three-day trip to Mount Moriah where he's called to do this. God gives him 3 days to think about what he's going to have to do. 3 days to change his mind. 3 days to turn around and say, you know what? Just can't do it. Not going to do it. 3 days, knowing what awaits at the end when he gets there. They travel to Mount Moriah. Verse 4. On the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes, saw the place from afar, and said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship you and come back to you. There you see Abraham's faith. He's going to see this thing through to the end. He doesn't know. It's so easy for us to look at this account and say, hey, Abraham's going to be okay. It's not that big a deal because we know how it ends. We know that God is going to use an angel and reach out at that very last moment and prevent Abraham from landing that fatal blow. But Abraham doesn't. And imagine someone coming to you in the midst of one of the greatest trials of your life, as you're there going through the fire, and they say, hey, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. You're going to get through this. I've seen the end. That's comforting perhaps in a sense, but you're still feeling the flames of that. Abraham doesn't know what's going to happen. But his faith in God is so strong that when he says, we're going to go up on the mountain, we're going to worship God, we're going to come back, it's filled with faith. And so his faith is being revealed. His faith is being shown. His faith is being tested. And it's going to come through as something precious and beautiful. Verse 7. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, my father, and he said, here I am, my son. Behold the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Here's the faith again. Verse 8. Abraham said, God will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they both went on together. When they came to the place where God had told him, Abraham built the altar there, laid the wood in order, bound Isaac his son, laid him on the altar, on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But an angel of the Lord called in him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. We understand that God knows all things. God is omniscient. God knew from that moment that he called Abraham. That's why he called Abraham, because he knew that Abraham was going to be a man of faith. That's why he chose him. And so he knew that this moment was going to occur before it happened. For what reason then does he say, now I know? Well, whenever the moment actually occurred, God knew what was going to happen. He could foresee Abraham's actions and faith, and it wasn't as if he was ignorant of it, because he's omniscient. He knows all things. Nothing is hidden from him. But now that this has happened, Things have happened, there's knowing something in your mind that's true, but then there's knowing it experientially. That is, now that it's happened, you know by experience. And I really think this is more for us, and I think this is more for Abraham, as his faith is tested here. And now, when we want to talk about what strong faith looks like, what trusting in God looks like, so oftentimes we come back here to Genesis chapter 22, and we point to Abraham, and we say, this is what faith looks like. But oh, what a trial it must have been for him in that moment. But what does it do? It reveals the deep faith that he had in God. And when hard times come our way, in whatever form that they do, that's what they do. That's not God punishing us. That's not God angry at us. That's God working in our life. That's God chiseling away. That's God putting us through the fire, burning away the dross, burning away the impurities, shaping us, molding us, and showing us. This is what your faith looks like. And maybe as we go through the trial, we realize, oh, my faith isn't what it needs to be. My faith needs to grow. Maybe we complain. Maybe we're bitter. Maybe we're angry. Maybe we don't have the faith, and maybe we doubt and deal with fears and anxieties and all of those things as we're going through the fire. And we come out of that thinking, okay, my faith needs some work. Or maybe we come through, hopefully we come through, with like Abraham, with our faith having been tested or tried, and shown to be strong. Not only do trials test our faith, they also reveal what we love most. Let's look real quick at Matthew chapter 19. Matthew 19. What do you love most? Who do you love the most? Trials will tell you what you do. As many people go through trials and go through troubles, and maybe this is the sense in which a trial comes to us. We've got a choice to make. Who or what are we going to choose? We meet such a young man to whom Jesus puts through a trial, be a question, and reveals to him what he loves the most. Matthew chapter 19, starting in verse 16, behold, a man came up to him and said, Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? And he said, Why do you ask me about what is good? There is only one who is good. You would enter life, keep the commandments. He said to him, which ones? And Jesus said, you shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The young man said to him, all of these things I have kept, what do I still lack? And Jesus said to him, if you would be perfect, go sell what you possess and give to the poor. You will have treasures in heaven. Come follow me. When the young man heard this, he went away salt. We had great possessions. This young man, if you would have asked him prior to this encounter, what do you love the most? I love God the most. If I were to ask you this morning, what do you love the most? Well, doubtless, I know your answer would be the same as mine. I love God the most. What trials will often do, though, is they'll show whether that answer is true. If Jesus says before this man two things, show me your love for God. Let me just see your love for God. The call to follow Jesus is the call to sacrifice. You've got a choice to make. Because I can see within your heart, and as he was going through all of those things, I've kept all of these laws, going back to the 10. He left one out. You shall not covet. And it's here, and the young man replied, I've done all those things since my youth. I've kept the law, kept the commandments. You shall not covet. Okay. Leave your money. Give it all away. Sell all that you have. Come follow me. You can't do it. He went away sorrowful. Why was he sorrowful? I think he was sorrowful because he saw that he didn't love the Lord as much as he thought he did. I mean, he still had all of his money. Jesus didn't make him give that away. He gave him the option and said, if you want to be perfect, then do this. But it was revealed to him that he didn't love God as much as he thought he did. But he went back to his money, went back to his possessions, he went back to his wealth, sorrowful. And in the same way, trials will do that with us. Trials will show what we love the most. Perhaps the trial comes to us in the form of us losing our job. And we don't have a source of income anymore, and we're forced to downsize, and we're forced to get rid of all the nice things that we have. What are we going to do in those moments of loss? Or what are we going to do when we're called to sacrifice? When we're called to lay down something that we hold very dear, whether it's a relationship with a person or someone in our life or something that we have that we enjoy, our riches, our wealth, our abundance, What if we're called to lay that down, either through loss or for the benefit of the kingdom? What are we going to do? Your trial will show you what you hold most dear, what you love the most. The trials will expose our answer and put us through the fire and force us to confront what's really most precious to us, just as they did this young man. Thirdly, trials enable us to help others in their suffering. Look real quickly. We'll tell you what. Let's just go to Luke chapter 22. We'll look there in just a moment. This is training. This is preparation. This is molding and conforming. This is the chisel of God working in our life to equip us and to make us look more like Jesus. And Jesus was the ultimate comforter. Paul talks about it in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 through 5. He says, we've been afflicted in various ways, but we've been comforted. And then he goes on to say, those who are afflicted will receive comfort from God. They are to then go and share that same comfort with others who are going through the affliction that they were going through. Sometimes that's what trials do, is they equip us to relate to someone in a unique way, someone who is suffering in a unique way, whether it may be illness or a specific type of loss. You know, when someone's going through a hard time, I can't say to someone who is dealing with cancer, hey, I know what you're going through. I know how hard that is. I know the pain and the difficulty of that. I can't say that because I've never dealt with that. For someone who is dealing with the loss of a child or seeing their child depart from the faith, I can't go to them and I can't relate to them and I can't comfort them with those specific words. I can comfort them in different ways, but I can't by having experienced that myself, having walked a mile in their shoes, I can't comfort them in that way. God brings certain things into our life, hardship into our life, to equip us in order that we might help those who are hurting in unique ways. And I understand the temptation. We don't want to dredge up the worst things of our life, the worst experiences and the worst days of our life. We don't want to relive them. We don't want to think about them. We want to put them away and bury them. But listen, that's not what Jesus calls us to do. And that may not be why Jesus allowed us to go through that trial and to go through the pain and suffering of whatever experience it was. He did that so that we can in turn and comfort others who are going through similar hardships. Listen to what he tells Peter in Luke chapter 22, verses 31 and 32, as he's telling Peter about a trial that he's about to go through. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. You talk about a trial. Peter's going to be sifted by Satan. Listen to this verse 32. But I have prayed for you, that your faith may not fail. And here it is. And you've turned again. And you've repented. And you've come back to me. Strengthen your brothers. He used to use the hardship that he experienced, the sin that he fell into, and perhaps even our sin, terrible though it was, and God would not have us do that. Perhaps we can even use those moments of weakness, those moments of doubt, those moments where we disobey to comfort and strengthen others. Maybe someone who is battling the same struggle that we were. They're fighting the same temptation that we were. Or maybe it's an illness, or maybe it's a loss, or maybe it's some experience that few people have. And we've gone through that, and God has faithfully brought us through to the other side. What then shall we do? Strengthen your brothers. Comfort those who are going through similar afflictions. You can't think about that and not think about Jesus. Listen to what's said about Jesus in Hebrews chapter 2. We often wonder, young children will often ask, why did God have to become a man? Hebrews chapter 2, 17 and 18. And why do we have such comfort? Why do we sing songs like, tell it to Jesus alone? Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest to God. Because he himself has suffered when tempted, he's able to help us who are tempted. Jesus is relatable. But before Jesus came to earth, clothed himself with flesh, God knows all things. God knew all things. But God didn't know what it was like to be tempted. Because you go to James and find out God can't be tempted, nor can he tempt anyone. And so it was impossible for God to experience temptation as to what it was like. It's impossible for God to experience sickness, possible for God to experience death. And that's why the Hebrew writer says, therefore he had to be made like his brothers. Because now Jesus, as our high priest, can intercede from the voice of experience and the position of experience, because like us, he's walked in the flesh. Like us, he's dealt with sickness. Like us, he's suffered loss. Like us, he's been betrayed. Like us, like humanity, he has experienced death. But that equips him all the more to intercede on our behalf as we're tempted. And so we find great comfort in that. Trials equip us and enable us to help others in their suffering. And then finally, trials call us to a heavenly hope. We'll call, close with one passage from Colossians chapter 3. It's so easy on those good days, isn't it? When all is well and all is right in our world, it's so easy to love the life that God has given us so much. And it's so easy to push the heavenly hope to the back burner, because life here is good. Do you think we yearn for heaven if our life is filled with good things all the time? If there were never cloudy days, if there was never pain, if there was never sickness, if there was never sorrow, if there was never loss, would we long for heaven? I can't say that we would. I can't see that we would, because I know the struggle. Whenever everything's going good, when all is joy and peace and pleasure before you, it is hard to think about heaven. When do you think most about heaven? When is heaven most dear? When you're hurting, when you're suffering, when you're sorrowful. That's when you think about heaven. That's when you hold on to the hope of an eternity free from sin and sorrow and sadness and tears and death. When you're going through those things, that's when you hold on to the hope of heaven more strongly than when all is well. So Paul encourages us in Colossians 3, 1 and 2, if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. And so trials, sickness, suffering, pain, loss, death, saying goodbye, they call us to a hope that transcends, that can't be touched by the blight of sin and by the brokenness of our world. And they anchor us not in this world, and our hopes not in this world, but in the world to come, in the presence of God, where all is joy and peace forever. And so trials, hard times, they break our love for this world, and they cause us to cast our hope upon God and to cling to that which is to come, not on the things that are here and now. Going through trials, if you're not right now, just keep breathing, just keep living, because they'll come your way. They'll come your way inevitably. They'll come and go throughout life. Thank God for good days, because we need them. If life were just one big long trial, it would be hard to hold on to our faith. We need those good days, but we don't need the good days only, we need the bad days. God knows that. And so God, because he loves us so much, allows them to come into our life. That's the chisel by which God works, breaking us from this marble block of nothingness, shaping us in the image of Jesus, testing our faith and revealing to us where we stand, showing us what we love the most, setting our hope on things, not of this life, but of the next, and equipping us so that we might help one another, others who are dealing with suffering. So I pray that you'll think about these things, and I pray if you're going through trials right now that you'll delve into God's word, you'll look to others who are suffering for comfort. Maybe you've got a season of peace, or maybe you look for someone who's suffering. Maybe you reach out and be a unique voice of encouragement and help and hope to someone who is dealing with some pain, who is going through the fire, who may be battling to do everything they can to hold on to their faith. You use God's faithfulness to bring you through to be an encouragement to them. Would you bow with me?